This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Pete Ross, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 25th of July, these are our main stories. The International Criminal Court votes overwhelmingly to remove the Chief Prosecutor, Karim Khan, over sexual misconduct allegations. 10 people are killed in a Russian attack on a drone exhibition near the Ukrainian capital. And Israeli settlers attack several Palestinian villages in the occupied West Bank after a major confrontation left 6 people dead. Also in this podcast, wildfires continue to burn across parts of Spain and France, forcing over 150,000 people to evacuate. And
it was such a shunned topic for so long, like everyone was like, oh, I've got to hide my 50 Shades of Grey that I'm reading. Whereas like now everyone's out about it, and it's nice that we can all support each other.
We hear about the ever-growing popularity of romanticy, books blending romance and fantasy. We begin with the International Criminal Court's decision to remove its chief prosecutor from office after the ICC's governing body concluded Karim Khan had committed serious misconduct in connection to allegations of sexual abuse. On Friday, 82 of the court's 125 member states voted in favour of ousting Mr. Khan at a special meeting at the UN's headquarters in New York.
The Assembly has decided by majority of 82 states' parties that the elected official Prosecutor Karim Khan committed serious misconduct and a serious breach of duty under Article 46(1) of the Rome Statute, and to remove the elected official Prosecutor Karim Khan from office under Article 46, paragraph 2b of the Rome Statute.
That's the President of the Assembly of States Parties to the International Criminal Court, Päivi Kokkarinta. The vote brings to an end a more than 2-year saga that has put the court's reputation under intense scrutiny. Mr. Khan has led the ICC for 5 years, during which it issued arrest warrants against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as Hamas officials, President Putin of Russia, and the former President of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte. Leila Sadat, an international lawyer who worked as a special advisor to the ICC prosecutor for just over 10 years until 2023, gave us her reaction to Mr. Khan's dismissal.
I think that the prosecutor was his own worst enemy, if I can say so, in prolonging this, because I think had he decided a year ago to say, I deny the allegations, but for the good of the institution, I'm going to move forward, I think he could have had quite a dignified exit at that time. I think what happened is the process got prolonged. It turned into sort of a very litigious process, with the prosecutor going to the media, with lawyers getting involved, with civil society being fractured. And for 2 years, this completely polarized the Assembly of States parties and civil society organizations. And we saw Twitter battles happening. And so I think today the Assembly of States parties had to make a very tough decision about what is needed to provide the unity that this court needs to survive going forward in the face of aggression from Washington and Moscow.
The BBC's Anna Holligan covers the court in The Hague and has been following Mr. Khan's case throughout.
This is an unprecedented moment in the ICC's history, a time when the court has already been under intense scrutiny. So this was a meeting of the Assembly of States parties, 125 member states of the ICC at the UN's headquarters in New York. Out of those 125 members, 82 voted in favour of dismissing Karim Khan. And in a brief statement at the end of the meeting, you heard there from the ASP president, she said that the ICC staff had been working through this uncertainty. She praised their navigation and dedication and said they'd demonstrated resolve to continue to function and discharge critical mandate and support victims of atrocity crimes the world over. But it's impossible to separate this court from the action of its top prosecutor. And that's something now that supporters of the court are desperately battling with, in the hope that this will enable them to draw some kind of line under the investigations which have been happening. So the allegations first emerged in 2024. These allegations centred on claims that he had sexually harassed a junior aide over more than a year, escalated to non-consensual sexual conduct, and then he tried to discourage her, allegedly, from pursuing a complaint, all while he was, of course, the ICC's most powerful official. The woman whose lawyer, who worked as his assistant, had described a pattern that began with inappropriate familiarity on trips in his office, groping, putting his hand in her pocket, locking doors, asking her to lie on a hotel bed, and all culminated, she said, in sexual activity she didn't feel she was able to refuse, given the power imbalance. All of these allegations Karim Khan has consistently denied. His lawyer has posted a statement on social media saying he will seek legal mechanisms to appeal this decision. But those claims triggered an 18-month-long UN investigation that found a factual basis for non-consensual contact. A legal review then by three judges said the same evidence didn't prove misconduct beyond reasonable doubt. And then the court's oversight bureau later applied its own standard and concluded that Karim Khan had sexually harassed the aide, engaged in an improper sexual relationship, and recommended his dismissal. That's what the members were voting on, and that's what they have decided is the basis for him being removed from office.
Anna Holligan. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned of more Russian missile strikes in the next 48 hours. It follows a Russian strike on a drone technology exhibition outside the capital Kyiv, which killed at least 10 people. It's not the first such exhibition to be targeted and has raised questions about why an event showcasing pioneering drone technology was being openly held right on the outskirts of Kyiv, making it an easy target for Russian ballistic missiles. Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams, who's in the Ukrainian capital, told Sean Lay more about what appears to be a serious security breach.
We could hear at least one explosion, even from where we are, less than 20 miles away. And there were air raid warnings going on, and we could see air defences going up in that direction. So the question that a lot of people are asking is, why on earth was something like this being held out in the open, apparently well advertised in advance, when Russia has hit these sorts of exhibitions in the past? And that is what Ukraine's chief prosecutor, I think, is looking at quite closely.
Do we know what sort of people would have been attending this event? I mean, plainly, it's not one intended for the public.
No, I'm guessing these would have been people involved in Ukraine's burgeoning defence industry. This is something that is becoming a really huge part of the Ukrainian economy. So we're told there were representatives of Ukraine's defence industry present. We don't know if there are any government officials. It is possible also that foreigners were there, because there are a lot of companies doing business with the Ukrainians. We haven't heard about any foreign casualties, but we do know from the toll of dead and wounded that it was obviously quite a well-attended event. We think that three ballistic missiles were involved, one of which was intercepted and two of which landed. I think there's no doubt that Russia targeted this particular event. And again, that is going to be very much the focus of an inquiry, because normally when you go to anything to do with Ukraine's defense industry, there's a pretty hefty degree of security surrounding. Certainly when it comes to journalists filming, sometimes you get taken to places and you don't know where you're going or what you're going to see. So again, why this was such an open thing, I think, is a bit of a question.
I mean, is this something that Moscow has cause to be worried about, how the industry in Ukraine is developing?
It certainly does. And you only have to look at what's been happening now. Three times in the past week, Ukrainian long-range drones have hit depots of Russia's Wildberries online retailer. That's essentially Russia's version of Amazon, causing colossal damage. You know, these are attacks which ordinary Russians are going to be noticing. It is going to have an impact designed to hit the Russian economy where it hurts and where Russians will notice it.
Paul Adams in Kyiv. Israel says it's begun a major military operation in the occupied West Bank after four Palestinians and two Israelis were killed in a shooting. The incident happened in a Palestinian village south of Nablus, where Palestinians say a large group of Israeli settlers attacked their homes. Israel's army said the Palestinians had attacked a group of hikers. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson sent this report from Nablus.
Footage from the scene around Tel Village shows chaos, with several people on the ground and Israeli security forces firing at Palestinians as more than a dozen gunshots are heard. At one point, a Palestinian man is filmed wrestling a gun from an Israeli security guard and fatally shooting him before being shot and killed himself. One of four Palestinians from the same family understood to have been killed by Israeli forces. He also shot an Israeli soldier who later died. The conflict began with a group of Israelis walking around Tel Village in a Palestinian-controlled area that Israel forbids its citizens from entering. Israel's firebrand far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said the villages of the murderers must be treated in the same way as Gaza. For every Jew murdered, the enemy must suffer the loss of land and homes, he said. Israeli settlers have already launched attacks against several other Palestinian villages. While Palestinians are routinely killed and injured during attacks and confrontations with Israeli settlers, the killing of Israelis by Palestinians has tipped the West Bank into a dangerous moment.
Lucy Williamson. In India, large student protests are continuing in Delhi, and the agitation has also spread to other cities, with thousands marching in Mumbai and Calcutta on Friday. Students are demanding education reforms and the resignation of the education minister in what's perhaps the most significant challenge Narendra Modi has faced in his 12 years as prime minister. From the protest site in Delhi, the BBC's Yogita Lamai reports.
I've heard lots of slogans being shouted, calling for the education minister Dharmendra Pradhan to resign, which of course is the key main first demand that these protesters are making. At the protest site here in Delhi, nearly everywhere I look is a sea of people. It's really hard to estimate. I can certainly say it's in the thousands, but it's possibly more. It's sweltering hot here, and still, they don't really seem affected by it. And we've been asking a few people here, what is it? Why are they here?
My name is Wasif. Okay, so I came here just because I've seen the dedication of the youth and I feel I should be somewhere in a part of contribution so I can tell my next generation that I've been there, I've been the part of a revolution which is going to happen in some days.
We are no longer the largest democracy in the world. We are the largest autocracy in the world today. So I think respecting the people of this citizen, respecting the youth of the country, he must resign today.
So we're travelling away from the protest site, going from Delhi to Dehradun, which is about 3 hours away, it's a smaller city, to understand the strength of emotion that triggered the protests and that continue to sustain them. The NEET exam is a highly competitive entrance test for medical education in India. Every year, millions of students appear for this exam, and just in the past 3 years, the paper has leaked two times, which means students have had to go through the pressure of appearing for that exam again. And there are instances from across the country where students have simply not been able to cope with that pressure. Their families say they've taken their own lives because of it. And we're going to Dehradun to meet one such family. So now we're just on the outskirts of the city of Dehradun and we've come down a narrow lane where we're going to meet the family of Riya Kumari Thapa. And we're now about to speak to her father, Rajesh.
In my heart, she is still alive, but I really miss her. When I heard about the protests, I felt like this is a fight for my daughter, so I also joined them. No parent should go through the pain that I have.
During previous protests, the government has appeared confident when dealing with them. This time, it seems rattled to the extent that Prime Minister Modi released a video in the middle of the night directly addressing the issue.
Paper leak ek koi mamooli vishay nahi hai.
But even what he was offering in that video, as well as the negotiations that the protesters have had, have not resulted
in any breaking of the deadlock, because the key demand remains the resignation of the education minister.
Dharmendra Pradhan istifa do.
It's hard to predict how any protest will end, and it's important to say this protest at the moment does not affect Prime Minister Narendra Modi being in power. The next general election is not for 3 years. What it could be is a very dangerous moment for him in the turning of public sentiment against him.
Yogita Lamaye. Still to come in this podcast.
We lost our son, but I hope no one else repeats our mistake and suffers like we did.
After the death of an overnight delivery driver in South Korea, unions call for a ban to the practice. This is the Global News Podcast. More than 150,000 people have been evacuated across France and Spain as intense wildfires continue to burn across parts of both countries. Spanish officials say a fire raging near the capital Madrid, said to be the worst the region has ever seen, has become impossible for firefighters to control. Successive heat waves this summer have dried out vegetation, allowing fires to start and spread more easily. Francesco Martinez is the mayor of Burgo Hondo municipality, west of Madrid.
I'm 59 years old and I've never seen a fire this hot, never in my life. And it's dangerous, and it's not controlled yet. Right now, we are stuck inside because of the smoke. We have 100 people who have been evacuated. We have 50 of those in the town sports centre.
In southwest France, thousands escaped the Cap Ferret Peninsula by boat as fire crews battled what one official described as an extra-large fire. President Macron has mobilised the military to prop up exhausted firefighters. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek has the latest.
Day and night, Spanish firefighters have been trying to contain the blazes confronting them. The province of Ávila, to the west of the capital, is the main focus. At least 19,000 people have now been told to evacuate or, where appropriate, hunker down in their homes. Officials are talking of a perfect storm, with high temperatures, relentless wind, and several fire fronts merging. One resident, Enrique Martin, described his escape.
I had to run from my house. It was a ball of fire, and if I'd been 5 minutes later, it would have wiped us out. My wife put her foot down, and that proved crucial.
The Spanish police say they have arrested a man suspected of triggering one vast fire by using a farm vehicle, despite a ban on heavy machinery in the tinderbox conditions. Italy has also been battling wildfires this week, with dozens raging on the island of Sicily in recent days. Last month, the European Commission warned wildfires had started earlier this year and that a fleet of nearly 30 planes and helicopters, as well as 800 firefighters, had been pre-positioned across Europe. Officials said it was their most ambitious wildfire response yet. Every effort will be needed in the days and weeks to come, judging by the ferocity of the wildfires so far this summer.
Nick Beek. So, what's so different about this year and how bad is it? Professor Hannah Cloak is Regius Professor of Meteorology and Climate Science at Reading University here in the UK.
It's not quite yet the worst fire we have seen, but we're very early in the summer. And of course, it depends which region you're looking at. So in some of these regions, we've never seen these types of fires before. And of course, we've got tourists being evacuated. And that's very, very scary indeed for those people who are involved in that. The heat waves this summer have been particularly strong. So we've had a bit of a wet winter in many places that has allowed that vegetation to grow. And then we've had no rain at all. So it's dried out. So we've got all of that fuel ready to go. And then we've had these heat waves. And then, of course, people are often the problem. Lots and lots of wildfires get started by people igniting them. So all of these things working together has meant that we're in a very serious situation in the UK and Europe. Our summers are getting hotter. They're getting worse. And we know that is the basic physics of what we're seeing. Heat is one of those things where you can definitely say there is this really, really strong link between climate change and heat waves. And we've seen it's been really hot. So, yes, we're very, very sure these heat waves, these wildfires, and of course, some of the drought we're seeing as well is triggered by climate change. we have to learn to live with this. I mean, the fire comes near you, you know, what are you supposed to do? So some of that is about adapting our thinking to the fact that our summers are going to be different.
Professor Hannah Cloak. Next day delivery for groceries and other items is something that perhaps many of us have become accustomed to. In South Korea, deliveries are known to happen especially quickly. The country's online retailers promise that anything ordered before midnight will arrive at one's door early the next day. So-called rocket deliveries are incredibly convenient for consumers, but now workers' unions are calling for the practice to stop after a recent delivery driver's death. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jake Kwon, took a ride with a driver to see the work that sparked such concern.
It is 11 p.m. and I'm riding in the passenger seat in Kim's delivery truck. The 35-year-old weaves his truck around the narrow alleys here in Incheon City, west of capital Seoul.
I work from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m.
What are you thinking?
I just want it to end soon. Please, no five-floor walk-up. I hope it's a lower floor and no heavy stuff.
This is how convenience arrives. Kim is carrying everything from toilet paper to fresh fruit. In the hyper-connected South Korea, anything ordered before midnight will arrive by 7 a.m.
His pace is absolutely frantic. Every minute or so, he makes a stop, and he's never walking. He's running everywhere.
The 300 parcels must arrive in time, or he could lose this territory to a competing driver.
This job eats away at your body, so it's not something you do for the rest of your life.
But the money makes it worth it for Kim. He earns $4,600 or £3,400 each month. That's double the national average. And during the day, he can spend time with his wife and soon-to-be-born child. However, in recent months, his work became the topic of a national debate when a nighttime delivery worker died after his truck hit a pole. Oh Seung-yong drove more than 11 hours overnight, 6 days a week. His schedule barely left him time to attend his father's funeral days earlier. Soon after, the delivery workers' union called for an end to nighttime deliveries. They pointed their finger at the online retailer Coupang that had subcontracted him. The company carries out most of the nighttime deliveries in the country. We met Pang Mi-suk in front of Coupang's Seoul office. She's fighting to end the nighttime delivery. Her 27-year-old son died after a night shift at Coupang's warehouse 5 years ago.
That day he entered the shower but didn't come out. So we went into the bathroom and found him hunched over in the tub.
Chang Deok-jun lost 33 pounds of weight during the 16 months he worked overnight.
We lost our son, but I hope no one else repeats our mistake and suffers like we did.
In December, Park and Oh Seung-yong's sister confronted the CEO of Coupang in a parliamentary hearing.
I am so sorry, and I offer you my deepest congrats.
The company said deaths among their direct employees are near zero, and it strictly limits work hours to 52 hours a week. It also pointed out that nighttime workers suffer fewer deaths than those working daytime. But Park and the union argue that the nighttime work harms workers' health over a long time. But the most vocal supporters of the overnight delivery are the workers themselves.
We chose to deliver overnight for money. It doesn't make sense for me that I can't do this because of my health.
And despite the controversy, the demand for overnight delivery has barely slowed, says Kim. The shoppers have tasted the convenience, and they're not going back.
Jake Kwon reporting from South Korea. It's fair to say relations between Canada and the US are at a low ebb. Earlier this year, President Trump said he wanted to annex his northern neighbour, and now he plans to hit it with more tariffs. Now, after decades of construction, a new bridge linking the two countries has opened with a pared-back ceremony on Friday. But Canada disinvited American officials from the inauguration of the Geordie Howe International Bridge after a dispute over toll sharing and new threats of 50% tariffs from President Trump. The Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, addressed the opening ceremony.
Our relationship has been challenged over the last few years.
and President Trump has threatened new tariffs just this month. But Team Canada has never been more united. And I want to make it clear, working with Prime Minister Carney will never stop standing up for Ontario and for Team Canada.
Our Canada reporter Nadine Youssef told Nick Miles more.
The original plan was to have both the Americans and the Canadians celebrating the bridge opening together. The U.S. ambassador to Canada, Pete Hoekstra, and some U.S. lawmakers were supposed to be there. You know, that plan has effectively been called off because of the latest tariffs threatened by U.S. President Donald Trump. And the Canadian side decided to have their own celebration instead without the Americans on the Canadian side of the border. And it's interesting when you see some visions of it, you know, it's included some pointed shows of Canadian identity. They had children playing street hockey, officials wearing pins that only show the Canadian flag. Ontario Premier Doug Ford delivered his remarks wearing a Canadian ice hockey jersey. So definitely, I would say, a big show of defiant nationalism here.
It's supposed to symbolize this unity, but it's symbolizing this fraught relationship now between the two countries, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the bridge is 25 years in the making, and it was supposed to support billions of dollars of trade that flow through the U.S. and Canada every year. That is still what it is going to do if it goes ahead and opens officially on Monday. But the path to get here has been very rocky. It was supposed to open earlier this year in March, but President Trump had blocked it effectively, saying that he won't let it open until Canada agrees to a better deal with the U.S. on the bridge's ownership and how revenues are collected.
And do ordinary Canadians generally support this latest move from their government?
You know, I will say that Canadians are upset and they're angry, not with the American people, which is an important distinction here, but with the Trump administration specifically, whom they feel that they cannot be trusted. And, you know, there are people boycotting U.S. products still. Travel by Canadians to the U.S. has ticked up a little bit, but not the near levels that it was before President Trump's return to the White House. So I would say that Canadians are upset that the relationship has gotten to this low point, but they do want to see some defiance from their government.
Nadine Youssef speaking to Nick Miles. A new genre of fiction called romantasy has emerged in recent years, fusing romance and fantasy. Online recommendations, particularly from young women readers on social media platforms such as TikTok or BookTok, have boosted romantasy into becoming one of the most widely discussed genres today. Well, the UK's first bookshop especially devoted to romantasy has just opened. It's in the city of Oxford and it's called Bad Girl Books. Simran Sohal went along to meet its owner and to chat to some of its customers.
The city of Oxford, known for its ancient colleges, dreaming spires, and centuries of history, but tucked between the cobblestones and castle walls, is something decidedly more modern. Customers queue outside the bright pink doors of Bad Girl Books, the UK's first bookshop dedicated entirely to romantasy. It was once a niche online craze, but the genre has become one of publishing's biggest success stories. Inside, readers escape into magical worlds where dragons, destiny, and love stories all compete for attention. Starlin Marlett is the owner.
I spent years on Reddit, BookTok, Instagram, trying to chat to people about like my favorite books, ask for recommendations, and it was so wonderful and fulfilling. But I love to chat in real life as well, and so I wanted to find these people to connect with. And some of the people I'd been like BookTok friends with, they came and they brought me flowers. It made me emotional talking about it because I just love the community so much. People might be curious about why romantasy is so popular now. It just, the world can feel so bleak, and I think romantasy is such a great way for people, and particularly women who are experiencing oppression in lots of different countries all over, to feel women's stories are being told in a woman's perspective, where they're saving the world, ending evil, they're leading armies, and it's so interesting and like so different from the real world that it just feels empowering.
In normal bookshops, the sections may be divided into crime, thriller, fiction and non-fiction, but here the shelves are labelled unhinged, monster smut and LGBTQ. What's smut?
So smut is spice or hot scene. So that term spice originated online to describe how hot a scene was. So if there was a lot of tension or explicit scenes, it would have multiple chili peppers. And so it just sort of evolved over the years to become a spice scale.
I'm Meg. So what draws you into romantasy? It's like pure escapism. You can have like a really naff day. You can go home and you can get lost in a book, and it can be worlds away from where you are, which I love.
How important is it for you to be in a space like this, in an independent bookshop that is catered just for romantasy books?
I think it's just really important to support women. It feels like a safe space to come. It was such a shunned topic for so long. Like, everyone was like, oh, I've got to hide my 50 Shades of Grey that I'm reading. Whereas like now everyone's out about it, and it's nice that we can all support each other.
I am James, I'm 28 years old.
Do people kind of judge you as a male reading these books?
Probably. Also, who cares, right? If you've got a book you like, read it. If someone's stigmatic, that's their problem. And I think that's why we need more guys being openly reading of romantasy books.
I'm Adele, I'm from Farringdon.
And so what got you into the genre in the first place?
It is fairly new, and I think probably most people's gateways is something like Fourth Wing. I think that's pretty much where I started, and then it just went a little bit insane from there.
How does it feel like coming into a physical bookstore rather than getting them online?
Pretty much like when my children go into the Lego shop, I would imagine, yeah. I want all of the things.
Simran Sohal. And that's all from us for now. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition of the Global News Podcast was mixed by Hannah Montgomery, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Pete Ross. Until next time, goodbye.